Welcome back to Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to loop back now to our review of the wealth gap from our series The Lines Between Us, which focused on the causes of racial and class disparities in the Baltimore region. Let's continue looking at how the wealth gap exacerbates race and class lines over time. Earlier, we heard the story of Isaac Joseph Bacon, an African-American World War II veteran. In 1950, he bought a house in a nice neighborhood by Drude Hill Park. It's close to landmarks we heard a lot about this spring during the riot and protests after Freddie Gray's funeral. The house is about two blocks south of Mondawmin Mall and about six blocks north of Penn North. Home values did not appreciate in that neighborhood, and as Mr. Bacon grew frail in his late 80s, his family scrambled to pay for assisted living. That's the story of the wealth gap in a nutshell. Middle-class Americans have traditionally built their wealth through home equity. As the suburbs were built up, partly to satisfy demand from the GI Bill, whites moved to the suburbs from the cities and watched their home values appreciate over decades. For the most part, African-American homebuyers were excluded from that suburban boom. In November 2012, Ann Kubisch, then director of the Aspen Institute's Roundtable on Community Change, shared a personal story with Tom Hall, a story of her own family and that of a friend in Baltimore.
My husband, who is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, his parents bought a house in Livingston, New Jersey in 1964 for $20,000. Now, Livingston, New Jersey, at that time was a rising suburb on the just outside of New York and was largely white. So they bought their house in 1964 for $20,000 at the same time that my very good friend in Baltimore's parents bought their house in 1964 for $20,000. My parents-in-law, my husband's parents, sold their house in 2002 for $475,000. Now, my friend in Baltimore, her mother cannot sell her house today for $90,000. So that is a huge difference in wealth accumulation that occurred over the course of a 40-year period.
We talked about some of the factors that play into the reasons that one house appreciates so much and another does not. But on a personal level, your parents-in-law and your friends' families, how are these effects taking hold in their lives as we speak?
Well, the first and most important thing is that my parents-in-law have wealth today at age 80. They were able to convert that house into cash that allowed them to then buy a place in a beautiful retirement community that's one of these fabulous places that's nice, clean, safe, with exercise facilities and a community center. And as they decline in health, they can move into the nursing facility that's there. And in essence, they're taken care of for life. And they were able to buy into that after they sold their house. And they have money left over because they're going to be able to leave something to their children and their grandchildren. Whereas my friend in Baltimore, her mother can't sell her house. So first of all, she's locked in there, so she can't get any cash out of it at this point, or she might be able to do it at a huge loss, which she's not willing to do because she, of course, invested in her house thinking that that was going to be a way to supplement her retirement. So that's the biggest difference that we can see today. And so we, my husband and I, actually benefit from the residue of those policies and practices in the 60s and 70s because we do not have to pay for the care of his parents as they age, whereas many of my colleagues who are African American and my friend whose mother is still in Baltimore, she has to use her own current income to help her mother meet her expenses. We do not have to do that. We get to continue to accumulate wealth at a faster rate, which also means that we get to invest differently in our children. We can send our children to private school. We can send our child to college without having to take out a loan. These are the kinds of things that wealth allows you to buy, which is really the key to social mobility in America. And so what we see is that these things keep getting reproduced over time.
With something like the GI Bill, for example, some folks would say, okay, well, here's two families. They were both given the means to purchase a home. And in this case, it's virtually the same amount of money. What is the role of individual initiative and smarts about investing and smarts about working and opportunities that might have been available to everybody, even back in the 60s? How does that play into it?
Well, Tom, that's a very good question, because so many times people put this down to individual hard work and individual initiative. But what we see is that we have two fabulous families, both of whom thought they were doing the right thing, and they were, according to the rules of the game at the time. But what happened to my friend's family in Baltimore is that because she lived in a primarily African-American neighborhood, the value of her property simply did not appreciate the way it did in the largely white suburban town of Livingston, New Jersey. And that's because people perceive that property that's owned by blacks is not as valuable or as investment worthy as property that's owned by whites. And so as a result, the value of those properties keeps going up and up and up because they're desirable over time, whereas the value of the African American property does not appreciate at the same rate. So sometimes what people will say is, geez, why didn't my friend in Baltimore's parents get smart and just sell their property and do exactly what my father-in-law did and make smarter investment decisions? But in fact, they did all the right things. They played by all the right rules while their property values declined around them. And they declined around them because what we see over time in the United States is the properties and neighborhoods that are primarily African American either decline in value or don't increase in value the way that suburban, largely white housing property values do.
Anne Kubisch is the director of the Aspen Institute's Roundtable on Community Change. Anne, thank you so much for your professional expertise and sharing your personal story. We appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
At linesbetweenus.org, we have an Aspen Institute report about the roots of inequality. I'm Sheila Cast. Since Tom spoke with Anne Kubisch 3 years ago, she's left the Aspen Institute to become president of the Ford Family Foundation, which helps fund initiatives on childhood development and rural community development and leadership, among other issues. The Lines Between Us looked at many kinds of disparities in how the criminal justice system works, in how people find jobs, in redlining, in transportation, in schools. You can prowl through all 50 episodes at linesbetweenus.org. The series was awarded one of the most prestigious prizes in broadcast journalism, a 2014 Columbia University Alfred I. DuPont Award. You can catch a 3-minute video overview of the series at linesbetweenus.org. Marilyn Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1866, several dozen delegates from trade unions, assemblies, and so-called eight-hour leagues around the country were meeting in Baltimore. They had convened the previous day, and before they adjourned August 25th, they formed the first labor federation in the U.S., the National Labor Union, or NLU. It collapsed 8 years later, but it paved the way for other important groups representing workers, like the AFL, the American Federation of Labor. We're back on Monday. Hope you'll join us.